Well, good afternoon. Nice to see you all, and this is the first time I've ever spoken to a room full of balloons. So it's different. I don't know what colors they are. I got maroon and orange and white. That doesn't mean anything to me. Today, I want to talk about Antioch, the early church, and Paul. This is a picture, of Antioch, which is Antakya now in Turkey, looking from the south toward the mountains. This is a modern city, obviously. The reason why this is on my mind, one reason is obviously over the years, and you've seen this in my speaking and my interest, is that I'm interested in the context of the New Testament, of the whole Bible, but especially the New Testament, the world of the first believers in Jesus.
It's always interesting for me to look into different aspects of it more deeply. My brother facilitates I don't know how often they do it, but a Bible study during the week. And they have been going through the book of Acts recently, and he shares with me, not everything that he does, but he shares with me on occasion different resources that they look into and ask my input, my opinion. And so we went back and forth a few times about some things in the early chapters of Acts, and in the process, I had to revisit some of the things that I thought I understood, and maybe I'm not so sure now. And one of those things is something that I have said publicly more than once, but I know I've said it in this. I'm sure I've said it in this congregation, and I wanted to address that, and at least, if not correct, at least say, well, what I used to think I know, I'm not so sure I know anymore. And let you know that. It all has to do with the growth of Christianity, and Antioch is intimately involved with that. I'm going to talk a lot about the city at first, and then we'll get into the book of Acts. Why talk about Antioch? Well, it's a major center of the world of the New Testament, and it was one of the primary premier cities of the Roman Empire, the third most important city at the time that Jesus walked the earth. Behind Rome, obviously, what's the second most important city? Anybody want to guess? I'll get you involved here. Big important city in the Roman Empire. It's in Egypt, Alexandria. Alexandria was a huge city and had a lot of resources, a famous library and so forth. And it also became an important center of Christianity, as did Antioch. It was in the province called Syria at the time. And today, it's a ruin near this city of Antakya, which is in Turkey. Now, I'll show you some maps so you can get your bearings here. There were a lot of things that happened here. It was the first place, and you remember from the book of Acts, it's the first place that the early believers of the way, or whatever it was described, were called Christians or Messianics. So that would be a modern term that would mean something maybe. Messianics, in other words, people that believe that Jesus was the Messiah. This is the first city where the people of that belief were called that by that name. There is a tradition, I'll just share it with you, that Eusebius wrote that Peter was the first bishop of Antioch. I don't know if that's true or not, but just share it there. Talk a little bit about Antioch, if we would. I just think it might help us to get a picture for why this city matters. Why does it matter? Why do I care about Antioch? I do care about Antioch, and there's a good reason. Why was it important? First of all, let's talk about. We're just going to give you some background. Some of the background. Why is Antioch important? Well, one reason is because of Roman roads. And what you see here is a map of all the big major roads in the Roman Empire, the ones that they know about, and somebody just bothered to put a map together. And I don't think it was by chance. I think it was providential, and I've shared this with you before, that at the time that Jesus
walked the earth, and when he died and was resurrected and the Christian movement started, it was a unique
time in history. There was peace in this region. I mean, not the whole world necessarily, but in this region, what we call the West, I guess, there was peace enforced by the Roman legions. There was freedom of travel, especially if you're a Roman citizen, but even for other people. And not only was there freedom to travel, but there was a way to travel. You had all these roads, as well as sea routes. And there was a lot of traffic coming from down here, up here. Why? What was down here? Anybody remember? Sorry? Yeah, what was the traffic? What were they bringing from here to there? The Sahara Desert was, remember, the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. This was all farmland. It's now a desert. It was farmland then. And one of the time, Paul even, hopped, was on a ship, that one ship when he was taken as a prisoner. I believe it was a grain ship. Doesn't it say that? So there was plenty of shipping going this every which way in the Mediterranean. And you had all these roads, lots and lots of roads. The Romans built over 53,000 miles of roads. That's just hard to imagine. And they were good roads. Now, if I any amount of luck, I might be able to show you a video a little later. And in some of that, I don't know if the video clip that I'm showing you shows it or not, but they show Paul walking in a real stony, rocky, like he's going from this town to that town. I don't believe he was walking on stony, rocky places usually. He was walking on Roman roads. They had good roads between the cities. Why did they have good roads between the cities? Who built them? Romans. Why? And what part, what division of Roman society? You could say slaves maybe, but what were they built for?
For the soldiers.
You had to get that Roman legion, those Roman legions, where they needed to be quickly. So there are 53,000 miles of road to get those armies around where they need to go. They were built mostly by the army, but I'm sure they used slave labor. They might have had slaves in the army, I don't know. But it was done by hand, of course. And you could get anywhere, you could get from one place, if you were way down here, you could get all the way to Spain without going across the water. You could go all the way around if you want. You remember the expression, all roads lead to Rome? It's true. It's true. All the roads lead to Rome. You can get to Rome from anywhere. That's the way they did it. You could start, like I said, you could start traveling here, get all the way to Rome by going around on the roads. So it was an amazing thing. And why does that matter for Antioch? Well, Antioch, now I have to leave the lectern, but it's right about there. I don't know if that's the city. I can't read from here. Is that Antioch? Can anybody read it? Or there, one of those two. It's right there. You have main roads coming up this way from Africa. You have roads that I'm going to talk about that came from the east. And they intersected around the area of Antioch. So Antioch had great importance, not just in the Roman Empire, but before that. This is just a little bonus slide here on how the Romans built their roads. These weren't backwoods, log roads like we had in the United States a few hundred years ago. They had paving stones. They had pebbles and gravel. They had a foundation that was dug down 3 feet deep. And they had drainage ditches on the side. This was high tech. They were good roads. Some of the roads still exist today. There's a bridge that was built during the Roman Empire. I don't remember. Maybe I have it here, where the bridge is. I don't see it. I think I may have it somewhere. There's a bridge that still exists. I don't know if it's still in use, but these were good roads. These were good roads, and many of them have made it 2,000 years or 1,500 years or whatever to these days. And that to me is amazing. They built it right. And they had signposts to let you know how far it was to the next town or the next rest stop or whatever. I don't know. They had these markers. So that's something we see in our country, but it goes that tradition goes back at least 2,000 years. The Persian Royal Road. Well, this is an old road that was built by Darius the Great, in the 5th century BC. And it went all the way from Persia, and Persia came toward, here you have Greece. So you got this road. And why was it there? For trade. To get the goods and take the goods somewhere and bring the other goods back. That trip normally would take 90 days on foot. The road went from Sardis is there, all the way to Susa, I believe.
That would take 90 days on foot. Mounted couriers could do that distance. It's 1,677 miles. Mounted couriers could do it in 7 days. So if you had to get some news around the empire, they had roads, and they built roads to communicate. They built roads to get the goods. Herodotus, a famous Greek historian, he wrote, "There's nothing in the world that travels faster than these Persian couriers." And I didn't know this. You always learn something new every day. You know, what's that expression they say about the U.S. Postal Service? Or they used to? Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor darkness of night prevents these couriers from completing their designated stages with utmost speed. Herodotus wrote that about the Persian couriers. We just lifted it and put it on that post office in New York. But that's an old saying from Herodotus, a Greek historian. The Romans, The Romans improved the road quite a bit with the kind of technology that I just showed you, made it a better road, 6.25 meters wide, about a 20-foot road. It's kind of typical to what we would have in a subdivision. And, here we go, with stone curbing. And there's a stretch somewhere that still exists. They're talking about how and what good a shape it's in. And I believe this is where it says where the bridge is. They're talking about a 1,500-mile stretch, 11 posting stations maintained with a supply of fresh horses. Sounds like the Pony Express, right? Remember that? A quick mode of communication using relays of swift-mounted messengers. The construction of the road, as improved by Darius, was of such quality that the road continued to be used until Roman times. A bridge in Diyarbakir, maybe, Turkey, still stands from this period of the road's use. Okay, so the trade reached its peak at about the time of Alexander, and we'll talk more about him in a little bit. So this is one road. Now, Antioch is right about there. So this road doesn't come straight past Antioch, but if you were headed to Africa or whatever, you tie into this road, you got to go right past Antioch. So Antioch is ideally situated. This is a picture of what Antioch looked like in the old days. There was this island kind of that was surrounded by the Orontes River. The Orontes River was diverted later. I think there's still water there, but for the most part, it flows north and it flows toward the Mediterranean further south from the city now. It was founded near the end of the 4th century by someone named Seleucus I, Nicator, I don't know how to say his name. He was one of Alexander the Great's generals. It was a very important location because of Royal Road and also the Silk Road. We'll talk about, and the spices, all this trade that came from the Far East. Antioch became a cradle of Christianity as well. And it's also in an earthquake-prone region, and so its importance declined during the Middle Ages as it kept suffering earthquakes. So as long as the Roman Empire was prosperous, the emperors would help this town and other towns to recover from the earthquakes. But when the treasuries ran a little drier, eventually people started moving out. Also, its importance diminished because of the Islamic, when the Islamic peoples conquered various areas to the north and also to the east, and also finally when you get closer to our day, the Ottoman Empire actually caused this area and all these trade routes to be less important because they shut them down. And part of the impetus for trying to find sea routes was to get a route around Africa or a route the other direction to get to the Far East without going through the Silk Road or the Spice Road or all these famous trade routes that have been around for thousands of years. By the time the Ottomans controlled this, I don't know whether they just wouldn't let you through or the taxes were too high or whatever the duties, but the point was the Europeans said, well, let's try to figure out a way around, and that was part of what spurred the age of discovery and exploration. Here's the Silk and Spice. Now, the Silk Road is referring to the road from China that comes up here, and that's right, Antioch's right there. And then you have the Spice Road, bringing the spices from India and from Indochina coming up into Europe. And these were important trade routes. And once again, those trade routes all went around and near Antioch, which made it an important area. I said it was founded by one of Alexander's generals. You remember the story that when Alexander the Great died, he didn't have an heir. He did have a son, but the son wasn't born yet. He was born after Alexander died, actually. And so remember, his empire was split up among four generals. And that's something we read about in prophecy in the book of Daniel. And this is a German map, so I can't. It says Reich of this and Reich of that. You know, different reigns. You had the Ptolemaic Empire. You know, the Ptolemies down in Egypt. You had the Seleucids that had a huge area here, inherited a lot of the old Persian Empire. You had this area here was Lysicomus, I believe, and this was Cassander, if I have them all straight. And it was split up among the four generals. Of course, they immediately started fighting one another. And in the end, these areas were less important, and a lot of the territory ended up with the Ptolemies and the Seleucid rulers. And you recall, we've talked about this before, I think probably all of us that speak here have spoken about certain things that happened in the intertestamental period, the time that led up to the Jesus in the New Testament. One of the things that was going on when you had the Maccabees and all that is you had the people down here, the Ptolemies, fighting against the Seleucids. And what's in the middle? Judea, Jerusalem, in the middle. And this German map, this is really neat. I hope you can see this back there. Notice that the blue, which is at this, whatever year this is supposed to have been, and I don't know, it shows that the Ptolemy's empire actually encircled what is now, you know, Judea and Galilee and so forth. You see that? It encircled it. So that, you know, this is a really good map, I think, to show that there was always conflict between here. And in fact, in this case, the Ptolemies controlled the area, you know, around here, secluded by itself, was part of the Seleucid Empire that it was controlled. And Jerusalem was constantly changing hands. They were caught in the middle all the time. That's king of the south and king of the north that you read about in Daniel 11. anyway, the Seleucus, if that's how you say his name, Juan Nicator, was after his father. We'll talk about him in a minute. He was one who founded a lot of cities. He typically, the cities that he founded, he named after somebody in his family. And Antioch is named after his father, whose name was Antiochus. He was the first Antiochus. You've heard that name Antiochus before, right? Antiochus Epiphanes, the bad guy. The one that profaned the temple in the 2nd century B.C. This is another century or two before that. All right, stop me anytime when you see something interesting or want to comment on a map. I love this map, and I love it especially for that right there. It shows that at whatever time this was, the area that involved the people that wrote the Bible, they are apparently under the control of the Seleucid Empire or their families and rulers, but they are surrounded by areas controlled by the Ptolemies. So what kind of a situation is that? And that did not get solved. That whole back and forth and back and forth did not get solved until what? Rome. Rome just told them all, you know, told everybody where to go, and they controlled it all, and then you had freedom of movement, and there's no more fighting. And you remember the Roman, this was not the Roman Empire, this was the Roman Republic in the time B.C., and the one senator came down, drew a circle, I believe it was, or a line or something in the sand, said, you know, you don't leave this circle. Basically saying, telling the Ptolemies, you know, we're in control now. You back off. You can't read this back here. This is a Seleucid family tree. This is Antiochus. And Seleucus I Nicator is right here. So that's his father. And he named several cities. In fact, he founded several Antiochs. I think, did I read somewhere there were 16 Antiochs? And you heard about one, you know, Paul and maybe Barnabas or Silas, I forget who it was, visited Antioch in where? In Pisidia, right? That was up in Asia Minor. It's a different Antioch from this one. If you can read the names here, you probably can't, but... And I can't either. That's no good. There she is, Laodicea. You know, the city of Laodicea, named after her. And you'll see other names in here that cities and areas were named after. So that's what if you were a ruler then, you got to name cities after yourself. or your kids would, somebody would. Here's an artist's conception of what Antioch looked like back in the old days, and there are still remains of some of these fortifications that went up the mountain, apparently still there. There was a mixture of Roman, Greek, and Jewish elements that were, it says here, admirably adapted Antioch for the great part it played in the early history of Christianity. When the city was first founded, there were some local settlers, and then the people from Athens brought in others from neighboring areas, and also Jews. And interestingly enough, and this is important, when you read about the New Testament, you read about Paul, what was it? What was one thing that made Paul, I mean, there are many things, I guess, but what made Paul a perfect choice for traveling all over the empire? He was a Roman citizen. And Roman citizenship, sometimes you could buy it, but Paul made the point, you know, he was born that way. Why? Because he was from Tarsus, and the whole city were citizens. And it was the same way here. It was the same way in Antioch. In Antioch, the Jews were given full status from the beginning, and the whole city was given citizenship. So if you were from Antioch, you were a Roman citizen. And that's like an instant leg up in the world, right? You're a Roman citizen. It says the total free population of Antioch at its foundation has been estimated between 17,000 and 25,000. That does not include slaves or anybody who lived there before they built the city. During the late Hellenistic period and early Roman period, the Antioch population reached its peak of over 500,000 inhabitants. Some say 250,000, some say 600,000. It's hard to guess, but it was a large city for those times. That's in a period of time when Rome would have had close to 1 million people. Jerusalem would have had, what was it, 40 or 50,000 maybe? I forget. I think my brother's got a slide. This is my brother's slide. Some of these slides I got from him because I like them. And it was his background. This parchment background was his, so I took it and stuck it on all my slides because I liked it. But by the 4th century AD, because of the earthquakes and because of other things, and crusades. The crusades, every time there was a crusade trying to get to Jerusalem, they passed through Antioch, so it was hard. It was hard to be in the path of the Crusades, whether you were in Europe and you were Jewish, or whether you were either Islamic or Jewish or anybody else down in the Middle East. To be in the path of the Crusades was not a good place to be, because you were going to be looted, pillaged, and everything, every other thing. And it didn't do well for Antioch. Did not do well in the periods of the Crusades. Whoops! I keep doing the wrong thing here. The Roman Empire and the Roman emperors were kind to Antioch. And I can read a few details here. It says in this one quote that I have, they favored the city from the first, seeing it as a more suitable capital of the eastern side of the empire than Alexandria. Why? Because Alexandria, remember the other map, if we go back, Alexandria is down here. And the Roman Empire, to go back a little more, the Roman Empire doesn't go much further than the grasslands here where they grew the wheat, down into Africa. So to have a capital here in Alexandria, wherever it is, right about there, I think, to have a capital there, around it is not much. But to have it up here at the crossroads of all these important trade routes and so forth makes more sense. And the Roman Empire, it didn't go much past the Black Sea here. The Roman Empire, right about there is what they had control. But it made more sense to these people in Rome to say, to have a capital here than to have a capital down here. So because of that, there was good reason, or they thought there was good reason, to put money into this city of Antioch. And they did. They put plenty of money into the city over the years, not just recovering from earthquakes, but lots. I have trouble following my, it goes off into the other monitor, Brandon, so that is working. I can't find my cursor because it's off there somewhere. Just to give you an idea here, Julius Caesar visited in 47 BC. He's the one who gave it its freedom, meaning that they were all citizens, okay? And then they built a great temple to Jupiter. That was probably Octavian or Augustus's doing. And there was a forum, and they built the colonnade, and they did all this stuff to make it look like a Roman city. There was a lot of money spent. I'm not going to read. I got some books up here I won't read from. I'll just summarize. The Romans spent a lot of money. They did it through the Herods as well. Herods were known for being builders. They built cities, and one of the cities that they had influence over was Antioch at times, because the Rome ruled at times through client kings, and the Herods, especially Herod Agrippa, had control of this area for a while. I say control one of the Romans. He could only do whatever the Romans would allow him to do, but as long as he behaved himself, the Romans would put up with it. And we've talked about him before, and the Herod family. He also built Herod the Great built a large stoa, marketplace, in the east, and Agrippa built a whole suburb, a whole other part of the town. Different parts of the town were built at different times. This area on this island in the river that was built at a whole different time. The original settlement was here. This is my brother's slide. All right, there were 16. That's right, there were 16 cities called Antioch. This was the city. This was the biggest one. It was, and this is significant, it was 300 miles north of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's down here somewhere, and it's 300 miles north to Antioch. And he's got here, if you walk 20 miles a day, we've figured before that that's an average or maybe a little high. 20 miles a day would take you a couple of weeks to make that trip. If you're riding on something, you can get there faster. Okay, yeah, Jerusalem, somewhere between 40 and 80,000, Rome, 1 million. So this one, and this city, somewhere in between. It's a large city, even by modern times. You have 500,000 people, that's a large city. So Antioch was an important city, and it was at an important crossroads. Why do I bring all this up? Because a lot of things that happened in the book of Acts, and a lot of things that happened in how Christianity began to spread, took place in Antioch. And most of what we read in the New Testament is, or a lot of what we read, I shouldn't say most, of what we read is Jerusalem-centered, and we get that Jerusalem mindset, and that's where this was written, and that's where this happened, and that's where that happened. But when it comes to the spread of Christianity after the dispersion of the disciples from Jerusalem, Antioch is the center of what was going on. So you will understand more about what's going on in the New Testament by understanding more about Antioch, and that's the purpose for me going through this. Antioch was known for being wealthy. Edward Gibbon wrote that fashion was the only law, pleasure the only pursuit. The splendor of dress and furniture was the only distinction of the citizens of Antioch. The arts of luxury were honored. The serious and manly virtues were the subject of ridicule, and the contempt for female modesty and reverent age announced the universal corruption of the capital of the East. So Gibbon's kind of hard on it, but he's just saying that it's known for the good life, for having things, okay, very materialistic. And my brother's slide here says the population was wealthy. And he says, and I could show you other resources that say this, that archaeologists have proved this. You know, they've dug up the buildings. And you see the intricate and fancy floors that still exist. They're down there under the rubble. And if they had the money for that, they had money for a nice life. That's the point. And it was also known for, the great craftsmen. It was a place where there was enough money to employ the talented people who could work with their hands and create things. Another one of my brother's slides. He says it was a vibrant Jewish center. Now, I already mentioned that Jews were important citizens of Antioch. They were given full status as citizens right along with the rest of the citizens at the beginning. They didn't have to earn it or somehow get it separately. The city had a large population of Jewish origin in a quarter called the Caratian or something like that. And so there was a lot of travel back and forth even between Jerusalem and Antioch. There was an opulent suburb, it says here in this slide. There was a rich, the resources say, this suburb was the rich. It was if you live around the Washington area, there's a place called Potomac. It takes a lot of money to live in Potomac. Well, they had a Potomac. They had something called Daphne, and it had a source of really good water, and a lot of the Jews lived there. The Jews had a good life there. They were full citizens. They were not a persecuted minority or anything like that. There were many of them there, as many as 45,000, it says here, in the middle of the first century. So that's, you know, it could be as much as one-tenth, one or one-fifth of the population of Antioch were Jewish. The Greeks were interested. We read the resources. The Gentiles were interested in the Jewish culture and vice versa. It was a very cosmopolitan city. And it was a place where if you were of, maybe you were Gentile, you knew a lot about the Jews. You might even visit the synagogue once in a while. And if you were Jewish, you knew a lot about the Gentiles. Why is this? Same as Corinth. It was a crossroads between many trading routes. So it was a lot of travel, a lot of traffic. It's like living again in the Washington area where I've spent most of my life. There's all kinds of people that are coming and going all the time from all over the world. That's the way it was in Antioch. And it kind of lended itself to a little bit of a laxness when it came to law. And it says here on this slide, and I read this elsewhere, that the lax morality of the Romans, because of the lax morality of the Romans, some were attracted to the stricter code of the Jews, just to have some boundaries, just to say, well, you know, this is right and this is wrong. It was a very loose, you know, they were wealthy, they were doing well, and they were satisfied with themselves, and it was not a godly place, you put it that way. It could tend not to be a godly place, but there were a lot of Jews there who, to some extent or another, practiced Torah and were obedient. They even had a local, kind of a minor Sanhedrin, it says on this slide. In the late 4th century, there was said to be 100,000 Christians in this city. And at that time, there would have been about 200,000 altogether. So by the 300s, the estimates are that there was about half the population was Christian. So this is an area where Christianity grew. All right, I'm going to let's go to the Bible now. I'm going to go to Acts chapter 6. Acts chapter 6. This slide says Acts chapter 11, so we'll have to wait for that. Acts chapter 6. In verse 5, you remember the story in Acts chapter 6. The many people had come to Jerusalem, and they were there for the Feast of Pentecost. It was a pilgrimage festival, so many people left their homes all over the empire, came to Jerusalem, and because of the resurrection of Jesus and the beginning of the Jesus movement, the Christian, the Messianic Jews, whatever you want to call them, this was the beginning of Christianity. Because of that, some people didn't go home, or maybe they went home, sold their land, and came back. I'm not sure, but this was the place to be. For many reasons. Can you just expand your minds a little bit or stretch them here? Why do you think if you were a Jew who became a believer after Pentecost, right? After you saw the Holy Spirit descend on these country bumpkins from Galilee and they're speaking in other languages. Why would you think, you know, I don't need to go back home. I want to stay here. What reasons might you have? If you were back, you know, could you get yourself in their sandals? What reasons would you say, you know, I need to stay here. I need to stay here. Anybody?
Then you want to be around people that believe the same thing you do.
Okay, I think that's a good reason. I want to be around fellow believers. Okay. Anything else? Go ahead.
Let them know about what you know.
Okay, but you could do that. You can do that back home, too. But yeah, they had a missionary spirit. They wanted to let people know. Yes.
Was there any protection offered for them there?
I don't know. I mean, it was at the time there wasn't that the persecution was from the Jews, not from the Romans. I would suggest to you that these people thought that Jesus was coming back very, very soon, and they wanted to be here because his feet were going to be on the Mount of Olives. So this is where it was all going to happen. Why did they need to go home? They saw the Holy Spirit giving power to people to speak in tongues, in different languages. And Peter, in Acts 2, says, this is the fulfillment of the prophecy in Joel. You know, they saw that the kingdom was here. The only thing missing was the king. He just had to go and come back. But the kingdom had already started. And they expected the king, I think. I think the New Testament, especially in the beginning of it, that they expected the king to come back and take physical possession of his kingdom very soon. And I suggest that if you keep that in mind, it helps other things that you read in the New Testament to be more clear. You get to, you know, we're reading in the book of 1 John. Well, you're in the last decade, probably, of the first century. By then, they had a different perspective. Jesus didn't come right back. But they didn't know that, I don't think. I don't think this is being, you know, in any way not respectful. I don't think that Peter, the other apostles, nor Paul, when he was converted, understood that yet. They thought it was just a matter of whatever, a short matter, a short time. Jesus would be back. So these people didn't see a need to go back home. What's the point? It's all going to happen here. That's me talking. I just throw that out there. Because something has to explain it. Why would they go home? They stayed there. Well, back to Acts chapter 6. What you have is you have the local widows, the local people who were in need. It wasn't maybe only widows, but you had a collection. I've talked about this before. The Jews typically did a collection on Friday. They distributed at the beginning of the week. I don't know if they did it on Sunday or Monday, but they distributed what they collected on Friday. They distributed it to those in need, and then they had enough food and whatever else they needed for the rest of the week. They continued that. I mean, they didn't stop being Jews when after Jesus' resurrection. So they continued that process, and in the early church in the book of Acts, you read, oh, the Grecian widows were being neglected. What's that mean? Well, you had these visitors. You had visitors that were from all over the empire that didn't go back home, and some of them had needs. And the local people that took care of the distribution didn't, either one of two things, either maybe they were a little prejudiced, that could be, or let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say maybe they just didn't know all of the ones in need from out of town. They didn't know who they were. And so when they brought it, the problem to the apostles said, we can't, you know, we have other things to do. We shouldn't be worried about the distribution. So why don't you appoint some people that'll take care of it? And if you look at the list, in fact, I think where is it? This isn't good. If you look at the list of the names, I apologize for this because that's not coming back. I don't know. We'll see if I can get it. The list of names, those names, are they here? Yeah. Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. Notice those names. They're not Jewish names. They're not from Judea. These are Greek names. So the visitors picked from among their own people that would help with the distribution, picked other Greeks. And I apologize, but I'm going to have to, I'm not sure how this happened, so I don't know how to fix it. I'd have to undo and get back in. Then we'll go to Acts chapter 9 next. In Acts chapter 9, we don't need that right yet. Read about Saul in verse 1, right? And Saul had been there when Stephen was executed, and he had been given authority to put Christians to death. And it says here he was still breathing in verse 1, threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. He went to the high priest and got letters so he could go to Damascus. Now, Damascus was east of Jerusalem, not very far. He was going to go there and find if he could find anybody who was following the way, who was following this idea that Jesus was the Messiah, that this guy who had died as a criminal was the Messiah. And that was really the scandal. The scandal wasn't that there was a Messiah, but the scandal was that the Messiah did not deliver Israel from the Romans. In fact, he was killed by the Romans. He lost, it appears. And of course, to the Christians, he won. How did he win? Easy question. Rose from the dead. All right, he won. But that's not what they were looking for. They weren't looking for somebody to rise from the dead. They were looking for somebody who would never die in the first place. He would lead them in victory, okay? So, Paul we know the story. He was knocked down and blind, and Jesus called him for a special mission. And then this Ananias is supposed to lay hands on you, supposed to take care of him. And Ananias says, this is the Paul that kills us, you know. It's okay, Ananias, it's okay. And we read about that. And in verse 15, it says, the Lord said to him, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel. So he had a threefold audience that was intended, but obviously primarily and first listed as to the Gentiles. And Paul, after he was healed, he hung around Damascus for a while. He began to proclaim Jesus in the synagogue, saying that he is the Son of God. So Paul, right away, he's got energy. He's zealous. When he was killing Christians, he was zealous about that. Now he was preaching Christianity, and he's zealous about that. Paul was somebody who, in one way or another, was going to be somewhat in your face. He was going to bring the message right to you in a way that you couldn't escape it. That just seems to be his personality. And as soon as he understood about Jesus being Messiah, he started talking about it. He couldn't help himself. That's what he did. He kept increasing, it says in verse 22, in strength and confounding the Jews who lived in Damascus, proving that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus, this Jesus who died on a stake, was the Messiah. And then the Jews had enough of this, and they plotted to get rid of him. And it became known, and they actually had to lower him in a basket over a wall to get him out of town. And it says in verse 27, and this is important, that Barnabas took hold of him and brought him to the apostles. Barnabas embraced Paul. Barnabas reached out to Paul, and Barnabas forged a bond and a friendship with Paul that was going to be very important in days and years to come. It says also in verse 29 that he was talking and arguing with Hellenistic Jews. Paul had the education to be able to engage the Judean Jews or the Hellenistic Jews. He was from Tarsus. He was a Hellenistic Jew himself. Now, when I say that, I mean he could speak Greek and he could read Greek. He could understand the mentality. Some people would say, well, Hellenistic Jews can also mean God-fearers, people that are converted, that were Gentiles to begin with. That's possibly true. But again, those would be people with whom Paul would be very comfortable coming from Tarsus as he did. And finally, it says that Paul went back to Tarsus. That was his hometown, which was, I won't show you, I don't have the map up here now, but it was a little bit north, around the Mediterranean, just a little bit, just around the corner of the Mediterranean from Antioch. And so it says in verse 31, all the churches throughout Judea and Galilee and Samaria enjoyed peace, being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit. In chapter 10, don't need to go through it all. You're familiar. It could be the topic of another sermon. But Peter has the vision, right? The vision of the clean and unclean meats, or the unclean meats in particular. And in the vision, he's told to eat them. He says, no, I don't eat them. And what is the interpretation of it? He understands when he meets Cornelius that he is not to call any man common or unclean. And that's a significant thing. Don't want to skip it. Want to mention it because it meant that the wall, and I don't say that Peter understood this at first, but the wall that the Jews had built between themselves and the rest of humanity was gone. That God was revealing to Peter, you can't call another man common or unclean, as in not you, you know, as in they are so different than you that you can't have anything to do with them, and that God can't have anything to do with them. They need to become like you before God will deal with them. No. And that was very hard, very, very hard for Peter and the rest of the apostles to understand because they'd been raised in a culture that said exactly the opposite, and they thought they had good scriptural reason for believing what they did. So Peter was involved here, and God showed him something that was very important, and it was certainly necessary. And he realized, he said to Cornelius, he realized that God does not show partiality. And remember, they received the Spirit. They had the evidence of receiving the Holy Spirit before they were baptized. So if you have the Holy Spirit before you're baptized, you say, well, why should we forbid baptism? You need to go ahead and baptize them. And God was showing through that, you know, by a proof that they couldn't deny, that God was dealing with Cornelius and his family and, you know, friends, whoever was there. He was dealing with them without them converting to Judaism. And again, it took years, if they ever did, it took years for them to understand that and understand the implications of it. And it's part of the conflict throughout the rest of the New Testament between various ones in the church and between the Jews that weren't Christians and the Christians. Okay. Then we're going to get to chapter 11. And in chapter 11, Peter comes to, he comes back to Jerusalem, and what happens? Well, he has had interaction with Gentiles in their house. And the first thing that happens to him is they say, "Oh, what are you doing? What are you doing, Peter?" In chapter 11, verse 2, he came to Jerusalem, and those who were circumcised took issue with him and said, "You went to uncircumcised men and ate with them." And then he had to go through the whole thing. And at least some of the people there were happy about it and say, okay, you know, God has opened up the door to the Gentiles, that's good. But they still didn't understand quite what that meant. But you see, Paul later on, in I think it's the book of Romans, talks about that one reason why Jesus didn't come right back is because God was going to call Gentiles, and it was going to take time. You know, the Jews had their minds, their eyes blinded for a time until the fullness of the Gentiles would come, until enough of them were called. So Paul realized that there was time involved here, and that he needed to preach to the Gentiles. And eventually, I think the rest of the apostles came on board, and they understood that. Now, there was persecution. And we know about, you know, Stephen was martyred, and there was other persecution. And people were scattered. And that's what this one slide. People were scattered. And they ended up going to Antioch, some of them. Let's look in chapter 11 and in verse 19. It says, "Those who were scattered because of the persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch." Now, Phoenicia is on the coast of the Mediterranean. Cyprus is that island out there in the eastern Mediterranean. Antioch, of course, we've been talking about. "Speaking the word to no one except for the Jews alone." But then it says, "There were some of the men of Cyrene and Cyprus who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also about the Lord Jesus." So here you had some people that were from other parts of the empire who spoke Greek, who understood the Gentile mindset, because they grew up in areas where that was the way it was, and this is where they lived, and they began preaching to the Gentiles on their own. And it says, "The hand of the Lord was with them, and a large number who believed turned to the Lord. And the news about them reached the ears of the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas off to Antioch." So what you had here in Antioch is you have, from what we read in the book of Acts anyway, the first congregation forming of a mixture of Jews and believing Gentiles. And it's so many that they have to send Barnabas off. Now, here's where we get the first hint of something that I think I've been incorrect on. I don't think that there's any indication in the text here that these people were meeting in a synagogue. In fact, the indications are all the opposite. They were meeting in some kind of a church, a house church, or whatever. They were meeting on their own. They weren't meeting with the Jews, the unbelieving Jews. They had their own congregation, their own fellowship. There were enough of them that the believers in Jerusalem said, "We need to send somebody up to mentor them, to teach them." And they sent Barnabas up there. And of course, Barnabas did a good job. And it says in verse 25, then when he got there, and he was doing a good job, he thought, this is a good time to get Saul involved. And so he went to Tarsus and got Saul, brought him back to Antioch in verse 26. And for an entire year, they met with the church and taught considerable numbers. And the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. And of course, there was the problem that certain came from Jerusalem to Antioch. And, well, the problem's not yet, but they talk about the famine that was going to take place, and they took a collection. So these people, including Jews, were starting to actually show some charity toward their fellow Christians in Jerusalem. So that should have sent a good message. And they did send a contribution from Antioch, 300 miles south to Jerusalem, for the believers there. Chapter 12 goes into Peter's arrest, and it says in verse 25 of chapter 12 that Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem. So they had taken the gift, the gift down there. They fulfilled their mission, and they brought John Mark back with them. And now I'm going to, if I can play it, well, now I think I can because I've lost whatever else I was doing. I'm going to see if I can play something from a CD or a DVD called Peter and Paul. I'll try it. I can get it going here. This was a PBS special. I've shown clips from this before. I might not show a clip again, though. Yeah, it doesn't show it there, does it? Let's see. Give me a second, please. Well, maybe I'm not going to show it. Thought I could. I apologize for that. One of these days I'll figure all these things out. All right, Brad, I don't know what I got here.
It does sometimes flicker.
I'm getting a flicker? I'm getting something?
Yeah. I give us a couple seconds after a flicker.
All right, we'll give it a... Here we go. All right, we're talking about the people, the reason why there ended up being a congregation in up here in Antioch is because certain men from Cyrene and from Cyprus, oh, I get Cyprus right, yeah, they were among those that were scattered. They had been in Jerusalem, and because of the persecution resulting from Stephen, they moved 300 miles north to the area of Antioch, and they began preaching, not just to the Jews, but to the Gentiles. And that's what got it all going. Now, where that video clip would have ended was with the congregation in Antioch deciding, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, to send Barnabas and Saul on a journey to reach out to more Gentiles. Now, I submit to you that there's no way in the world that that's going to happen in a Jewish synagogue, that they weren't meeting in a Jewish synagogue. They were meeting on their own under the leadership of Barnabas, and then Saul came and joined them. It lists in chapter 13 Barnabas and various ones who were there, and it says they were ministering in verse 2 to the Lord and fasting, and the Holy Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work which I have called them." And when they fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them, they sent them away, and being sent by the Holy Spirit, they went down to Seleucia, and from there they sailed to Cyprus. So Seleucia, there he goes, so the Seleucids, they left their names everywhere. So they came down to the coast, and then they sailed to Cyprus right here. It mentions two cities that they went to in Cyprus before they left Cyprus and went up to Pamphylia. So here's, they were on, this was their, the Paul's first missionary journey. That's typically what it's called. And left from here at Antioch, went into Cyprus, and then went up to Asia Minor. This area is Turkey. And in fact, the border of Turkey, and I didn't show you, it does this, and even today, it comes down to that Antioch area. It includes this. This is part of Turkey. Once you get below there, you got Syria and Lebanon and so forth these days. So they went through the whole island, and then they went up to Pamphylia, this area right here. These are Roman provinces. Asia, the Roman province of Asia. It's not talking about India and China and Japan. It's this area right here. Here's Lycia, like Lysicamus, so I guess is where you maybe get that. And you have these different areas that were Roman provinces. There's Galatia, which had many cities in it. It wasn't its own city. Now let's continue on here. Notice it says in verse 14, they went from Perga and they went to Pisidian Antioch. They went to another place called Antioch, which is up here. But it's a different place. It's not the Antioch here. It's one of the 16, but much smaller. And it says when they went there, they sat in a synagogue and went down. So that's, the book of Acts always presents it that when Paul and the others were on these journeys, that they would start in the synagogue. They would start in a synagogue. And it says they sat down. After they read the law and the prophets, the synagogue officials, the local authorities said, "Do you have anything to say?" And it says that when he did, he offered him that, he got up and he gave a sermon. I'm not going to read the sermon, but it's a good sermon. You could read it. And it says that when they were going out after that, after the service was over, they begged that these things might be spoken to them again the next Sabbath. So this is a good reception. Like, oh, this is interesting. People like it. We can come back to the synagogue next Sabbath and do it again. And they did. And it says, when it had broken up, many Jews and God-fearing proselytes followed Barnabas and Saul and so forth. And it says in verse 44, the next Sabbath, the whole city... Nearly the whole city. That might be a slight exaggeration there. Just saying, look, everybody came. There's a big crowd the next week to hear the word of the Lord. But when the Jews saw the crowds, they were filled with jealousy and began contradicting the things spoken by Paul and were blaspheming. So now they started heckling and breaking it up, right? Paul and Barnabas spoke out boldly. And it says, you know, it lists what they said. And it says, verse 48, when the Gentiles heard this, they began rejoicing and glorifying God. You know, they were being told that the way of life was open to them. And not only that, they didn't have to become Jewish in order to participate. And it says, the word of the Lord, verse 49, was spread all around the whole region. But then it says in verse 50, but the Jews incited the devout women of prominence and the leading men of the city and instigated a persecution against Paul and Barnabas and drove them out of their district. So now you have it. Here they've gone into Antioch, and they've gone into these areas, and they're in another city now. But the point is that they were able to speak, and once they speak and it's received well, then the Jews began to persecute them. So were they? Here's my point or my question: are they welcome in the synagogue? Maybe the first week, maybe the second week, but after that, persecution sat in. They weren't welcome in the synagogue. The Gentiles rejoiced because they kept teaching the Gentiles, but they weren't welcome in the synagogue anymore. It says they shook the dust off their feet in verse 51, then they went to Iconium. So here's the list, and I think Dr. John's talked about Paul's journeys before, so this is just a reiteration. This is his first journey. Ended here, and then they turned around and went back through, and went back home, and ordained elders and did all that, or set people in charge. I don't know if they says they ordained elders, but they set things in order as on their way back through. It says they spoke boldly. But again, and when each city they would go to, here we got in Iconium, they entered the synagogue of the Jews in chapter 14, verse 1. Spoke in such a manner that a large number of the people believed, both Jews and Greeks. But the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. Therefore, they spent a long time there, speaking boldly with reliance upon the Lord, who was testifying to the word of his grace and granting them signs and wonders done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided. So now you had a problem between them. And some were ready to stone them. And they became aware of it and then fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe, and the surrounding areas. And it says then, in verse 19, the Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. Once again, I ask you, Was he welcome in the synagogue? I don't think so. They just tried to kill him. He and his followers were not welcome in the synagogue. This is something, you know, I've read this, I don't know how many times, but it just never sunk in until recently. Just reading the evidence here, it doesn't sound like they were welcome. They were the people, the representatives of the synagogue were trying to kill them and thought they had succeeded. And it says they went to all those cities and then they went back through. And they went back home. They went back through Cyprus and back home to Antioch. And Antioch was their home. Then it says that some came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So these people from Jerusalem, they weren't saying, I don't think it's fair to say they were saying that the Gentiles can't be part of the church. They're just saying you need to become Jewish first. So they got the message, but maybe only halfway. Maybe they thought, well, yeah, we certainly can have Gentiles in the church, but they need to become circumcised and take on the yoke of the law. And that's what chapter 15 is about. I'm not going to go into chapter 15 and what the conclusion was. You're familiar with that, and maybe we talk about it another time. But James, after they talked back and forth, Paul says, here's what's been happening in the area. We go into the areas, and and people are, you know, receiving the Spirit of God, and it's wonderful, and God is opening up the door to the Gentiles to be in the church before the king comes back, before Jesus comes back. We're going to have Gentiles that, you know, the prophets have said all this, and Peter said the same thing, that the prophets have looked forward to this time when the Gentiles will come to the ensign, the banner, right, which is Jesus. So they go back and forth, and in this, you know, these people come from Jerusalem and say, well, you got to do this. Paul says, no way. And not only that, you know, when they decide to send Paul, and who did they send? Paul and Barnabas, or they sent Paul down to Jerusalem. Who did he take with him? Titus, uncircumcised Titus. Paul was going down with an exclamation point. You know, if he really wanted to go down and just be real nicey-nice, he could have taken any number of people, but he took Titus. He took Titus. It's like, this guy is converted. He's got God's spirit. He's not circumcised. Look, you know, Exhibit A. That's Paul. That's who he took. So we have the whole story, and they come up with the list of things that they want the Gentiles to do. And at the end of that, and here's the point that I want to make and correct from that I've said before. In verse 21 of Acts 15, it says Moses, after they told, said, here's the things we want the Gentiles to do, this list, right? They write a letter. They're going to send it back with Paul. He said, and James says, for Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogue every Sabbath. I have said before that shows that the leaders in Jerusalem expected the newly converted Gentiles to attend, you know, to attend at the synagogues and learn about the Torah. I now tell you that I can't say that it means that. They wouldn't have been allowed, at least not given the evidence in the chapters that came right before that. They weren't welcome in the synagogues. Paul wasn't welcome in the synagogues, not after he preached what he preached. Now, maybe you could get in for a while, but once he realized what you're up to, at least if you were going to preach that way. Now, maybe if you kept your mouth shut, maybe you'd be welcome. I'm just telling you now that I want to retract that. I'm not sure exactly what verse 21 means. I'm not going to tell you what it means. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think, given what came before, and that's all they had. It's only been one missionary journey so far. We have Antioch as an example, and we have one missionary journey. And based on that one missionary journey and the experience in Antioch, this meeting takes place, and these things are decided. I don't think, given what Luke decides to share with us, that they try to stone Paul, and they're chasing him around from one city to another, I don't think that it's reasonable to expect that these men thought that the new converts would go back to the synagogue where their leaders had been persecuted and that were trying to stone them. That's my conclusion. I don't pretend to know exactly what it means there. It's interesting that verse 21 is not part of the letter. if they wanted them to go to the synagogue, you think it would have been part of the letter. But when you read down in verses 28, 29, it just lists the things. It says, if you do these things, you do well. Farewell. So verse 21 was said in the meeting between people. It wasn't part of the letter that was sent out. So make of that what you will. I'm not giving the answer. I'm just saying, based on what we just talked about and the way that Paul and the others were treated, I don't think that it's reasonable to assume that the leaders in Jerusalem expected the newly converted Gentiles to go to the synagogue. Not that they couldn't, it's not that you're not allowed to, it's just why given when Paul came back and reported what happened, you don't think they would say, well, good, we'll just send them to the synagogues then. It doesn't make sense. So, I wanted to talk about Antioch. Antioch is behind Alexandria, behind Rome, which we don't see, it's over here, the third most important city in the Roman Empire. And at times it vied with Alexandria and seemed to have the favor of the Roman emperors. It was a cosmopolitan place. It was very wealthy. It had a mixture of many Jews that were well off and lived in the good suburbs and were part of society in a very important way. The Jewish way of life was attractive, from what we read. It was attractive to the Gentiles who lived there, and the Gentiles would have been familiar. It proved to be fertile ground for the expansion of the church when they were forced out of the area of Judea by the persecution that resulted after Stephen. Some of them ended up in Antioch, and it was the largest, apparently anyway, the largest and most important church that formed outside of Jerusalem. It, by all indications, met on its own, did not meet in the synagogues, or if they could go to synagogue, they certainly met separately in addition, because they, on their own authority, and with the guidance, the leadership of the Spirit of God, appointed two individuals to go on a trip, a journey, to begin to spread the belief in the Messiah, Jesus being the Messiah, to begin to spread that to the Gentile world. So Antioch is an important central location of what was going on in the early New Testament. And all of Paul's journeys originated from here, or at least the two, the first and the second one. The third one kind of originated when he was arrested here and then had to go. But his missionary journeys, put it that way, originated from Antioch. I might have got my numbers wrong there, but this is where he received his commission. It wasn't necessarily from the Jerusalem church or from Peter or James or anybody like that. It was something that the Antioch congregation, that early on in the church's history, had the status and the authority to do this on their own. Certainly with God's blessing, I say on their own. It was something that God inspired. But I want to stress the importance of the city of Antioch and have that be in your mind. And when you read the New Testament, and especially when you read Paul, realize that his frame of reference was not so much Jerusalem. He visited, yeah. But he grew up here, Tarsus. That's where he's from. And he did his ministry, at least his sedentary ministry, when he wasn't traveling, in Antioch. And when he traveled, he basically traveled here. He traveled in Asia, and he traveled in Europe, out here. And he only went to Jerusalem to deliver the goods, deliver the offering that they sent the first time in the famine, to deliver the money the second time that he collected on the, was it the second trip? I didn't look it up, but they collected money for the people in Jerusalem, especially those that were from out of town that didn't have maybe a good means of income and who stayed there. So they collected money from the churches, and then Paul took it down to Jerusalem, and that's the journey he didn't really return from because he was arrested for supposedly having a Gentile in the confines of the temple where he wasn't allowed, and he was arrested and appealed to Caesar, and that's where why he ended up in Rome. But it had been prophesied that he would end up in Rome one way or another anyway, so it was all part of God's plan. So I hope you understand more about Antioch today, and I do hope and trust that that will help make the New Testament be even more real.